Call your attention this morning to the Gospel of John, chapter 9. John, chapter 9. By the way, how do you like this tie? First time I've ever worn it. You know where I got it? Father's Day. Has anybody else worn their tie? Raise your hand, men. Got about five of you. Okay. All right. So, we went all out on these ties. I think we paid, maybe $3 a piece. And so anyway, I just this morning about 6 o'clock, I was thinking, what tie am I going to wear today? I usually wear a black or a blue suit. And where my worldliness comes in is with the tie. And so I thought, you know what? I have not worn that tie. Matter of fact, it's still in the little plastic pouch. And so I thought that'll go good with a black suit. So anyway, if we give you a tie, wear it at least once, okay? Even if it did cost $3. All right, so anyway, changed at Shalom. What does that mean? That means that there was something that was one way, and all of a sudden it's a different way. That is what has happened to a man that we're going to talk about today. I've often heard people talk about evidences for salvation. And one of the first things that they want to do is they want to jump to Galatians chapter 5. And they want to talk about the fruits of the Spirit. I think there are 9 of them. And they will talk about the love, the joy, the peace, the long-suffering, the gentleness, the goodness, the meekness, the temperance, and all of those things. Well, those are the fruits of the Spirit. But when a person is first saved, do they really have all of those things immediately in their life? No, they really don't. As a matter of fact, when I got saved, I was almost 16 years old. I was about, less than probably a month from being 16 when I got saved. And I did not have any idea what the word temperance would have meant. I would have had to look it up. I might have heard the word meekness, but I'm thinking, what does that mean? I wouldn't have known that. But there was something that happened on that Sunday morning that I knew had happened. And I was changed in a moment and a twinkling of an eye, as the scriptures talk about. I was changed instantaneously. In one moment, I knew that I was a sinner, lost, and on my way to hell. And the next moment, there was an elation that was in my heart. There was a joy that was in my soul, knowing that something had changed. There was a metamorphosis that had taken place inside of me, and I was now a son of God. Now, in my life, I have known many people that have made a profession of faith. And many of those people during their Christian life have had periods of doubt in their Christian life. I have never had a period of doubt in mine. Now, that's not to say that if you have, that you've got a problem, because that's the norm. But I know that in my life, because of the transformation that took place, that something magnificent happened June the 11th, 1972. And so even in those times when I was out of fellowship with God, if somebody would have said, "Are you really a Christian?" Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had a guy ask me one time how to be saved when I had gotten out of the will of the Lord for about 10 months. And he said, "Can you tell me how to be saved?" And I said, his name was Tim. And I said, "Well, Tim, you know that I'm not really living for God right now. But yeah, I can tell you how to be saved." And I told him that if you will acknowledge your sin and you will ask Christ to save you from your sin and you repent of that sin, you can be saved. And he got saved. And I didn't lead him to Christ, but I told him how to be saved. And so there is a difference that happens in a person's life that is genuine. Now, I'll be honest with you. When I have been in meetings and I've seen people come walking down the aisle smacking their gum. Just, you know, I mean, just eating that gum. What are you coming for? I want to be saved. You sure? Yeah, that sounds cool. That sounds fun. Can I tell you that's not Holy Ghost conviction? You need to be saved from your sins because your sins are going to send you to hell. There needs to be something on the inside that is called conviction. That's a Bible word where that you know that you're lost and you need to be saved. It's not just some flippant attitude. It's not some little phrase that you might use. Oh, Jesus, save me. And then you go right back to living the hellish life that you've been living. That's not the change that the Bible talks about. Jack Hudson, who was a longtime pastor at the Northside Baptist Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, he is the one that's credited with saying this. He said, when I got saved, I got such a jerk that I've been out of step with the world ever since. When I got saved, I knew that I got saved and I didn't want to do the same things that I used to want to do. It was a changed life. And I love it when I hear people and they talk about their changed life. There's a gentleman that I know very little about, except I've started watching him a little bit on YouTube. I saw his testimony for the first time, might have been yesterday. I was up at the hospital and they had bounced me out of the ICU for a little while until the next visitation, and then that's when Sarah was going to be there. So I'm sitting there and I'm going just looking at some YouTube videos, and all of a sudden this guy that I've been watching but I didn't know his testimony, guy's name is David Wood. Now I knew a David Wood eons ago, but he's older than I am, and so I knew that wasn't the same one. So I'm looking at this guy and he is always brilliant when it comes to debating Muslim scholars. And he has become what is called an apologist. Now, let me just tell you, an apologist is not someone that makes apologies and saying, oh, I'm so sorry. That's not what an apologist is. An apologist is someone that makes a defense for something. In other words, he is defending the faith. And I have watched Mr. Wood, I have watched him on probably 10 or 15 different occasions where that he would simply, really, he would destroy the argument from the imam or one of the holy men of Islam. And the guy is brilliant, but I had no idea where he came from until yesterday. And I saw his testimony. And he talked about how that he was an atheist and how that he had gone to prison. And when he got into prison, he said his roommate, his prison cellmate, was a man that had become a believer. And he was reading his Bible. And he said, that was the first time that I was introduced to Christianity. And he went on about the things that he was involved in, whether it was the drug addiction or many of the other things. Basically, the guy was a psychopath. He was someone that did not care if he violated somebody else's rights. He didn't care if they got hurt. He didn't care if he stole from them. He didn't care about anybody except what he wanted to do until he met Jesus. And he went from being an atheist to being a Christian apologist for the Lord Jesus Christ. Can I tell you that's exactly what Christ does in people's lives? He takes them when they're going in one direction, he flips them around 180 degrees and they go in the other direction. And that's why Jack Hudson could say, when I got saved, I got such a jerk that I've been out of step with the world ever since. A Christian thinks differently than an unsaved person. And so the story today is about a blind man. Now, there are multiple stories in the New Testament about blind people. The Gospel of Matthew, there's a story where Jesus heals a couple of blind men. The Gospel of Mark, there's another blind man that Jesus uses spittle and clay to heal. But here in our text today, he is going to spit on the ground. He's going to take that spittle mixed with the dirt, the clay. He's going to rub it in the man's eyes. And then he's going to tell him to go, and he's going to say, wash at the pool of Siloam. And it does not matter the method that Jesus uses. If it mattered the method, then the focus with the world would be on the method instead of the master. We want to make sure that we keep our eyes on Jesus, because everybody does not get saved the same way. Now, we all come to the cross together, but the way that we get to that cross is different. I got saved before a Sunday school on that Sunday morning. They said, can you wait till church? No, I got to do it right now. But if you got saved at an altar during a service, even though that was a different time, you still got saved. And so the manner, the method is maybe different for each of us. The key is that we come to the master. So you may have been led to Christ at home. You may have been led to Christ at a basketball marathon. Brother Terry Chupp's here today. For many, many years, he has run bass tournaments. And then they would preach the gospel. And there have been hundreds and hundreds of men that have come to Christ as a result of those tournaments. They didn't get saved in a church. They got saved at a fishing tournament. But yet, they met the same Christ that I know. Many of those men are still serving the Lord today, just like Brother Chupp is. And so, you've got these men. The key is that we focus on Christ. If it were only one particular way, we would have people in a certain denomination, and they would be going around and they would say, let me mix some clay and some spittle and rub it on your eyes. The Lord can do what he chooses when he wants to do it. And he can use any method that he wants to do it. And so we need to keep that in mind. Now, what is Siloam? Well, the Pool of Siloam is a pool of water. It is located inside the walls of Old Jerusalem. Now you say, okay, well, what's the big deal about the location? Well, the big deal about the location is because that was the water supply that those kings of Judah needed, like Hezekiah, when Assyria and their leader Sennacherib, I always say this, and I don't know why, because I've told you probably five times, if you want to remember his name, just think of a sack of ribs. It's Sennacherib, all right? And so you've got the water supply that's inside of the old walls of Jerusalem. Now, that pool is mentioned in the Old Testament. You have the word Shylock, and I think the C-H is not the way we would pronounce it. It's kind of slurred a little bit in a Semitic language. And it has the meaning of sent or sending. That's the exact same meaning that Siloam has. Now, the Old Testament references are 2 Kings 20, 2 Chronicles 32, Isaiah 8, verse 6. Now, Hezekiah's tunnel is not a tunnel that you really walk through normally. In Israel, in the late 1800s, they found this tunnel and they excavated this tunnel. It had been closed off during the time of the Romans. And they excavated this. And today in Israel, if you go to Israel on a tour, If you're a fool, you can go through that tunnel. I've done it. I was a fool for doing it. Now what happens is this, or what happened is this. During the time of Hezekiah, old Sacharibs was outside. They had already conquered the north and they were coming against the south, because you remember Israel had been split into two sections, north and south. They had already taken a bunch of the little towns and communities outside of Jerusalem, which was in Judah, the south. But Hezekiah knew that he was coming. What can we do? I mean, the walls are fortified. We can fight them off that way. But what if they starve us out or thirst us out? So they began to stockpile grain. And they began to dig this tunnel. And it started in what is called the Gihon Springs. And it goes for 1,750 feet. And it's all kind of uphill. Now, it's amazing the engineering and the, you know, water goes downhill. But they're able to dig it in such a way where that the water would flow into the old city. And they would have a fresh water supply. And then they camouflaged and covered over the outside where the Gihon Springs was, so that the Assyrians would not know that the water supply was there, because the water would go underneath the ground and underneath through the rock bed into Old Jerusalem. That is Hezekiah's tunnel. Now that tunnel is 1/3 of a mile long. You go, that's no big deal. I've gone up Stone Mountain. I saw a girl the other day, and she was, at the hospital on Friday. She goes, I'm about to get off work, and I'm going to go to Stone Mountain and climb Stone Mountain. And I'm thinking, why? I've done that 40 years ago. And I'm thinking, I'll be honest with you, I don't know if there's enough money to have me do it again. Now, they might be. But I'm telling you, it'd have to be a bunch. But it's not just walking 1/3 of a mile. I'm about 5'9", 5'10", depending on what, you know, what scale I'm looking at and what measuring tape was being used. There's not a place hardly in that tunnel that's 5'10" walking straight up. When I went through that, I cannot tell you the number of times I had to walk like this. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, dear God, where's the end going to be? And then you'd have to do this. You'd have to get sideways. And there were some people that were bigger fools than I am, because there's two paths that you can go. I chose the one that was dry. But there is literally a path of Hezekiah's tunnel that has water in it that comes up to your thighs. And some of them went through that. And I'm thinking, that's not for me. And so you've got this pool that is inside of that old city of Jerusalem. And that is where the Pool of Siloam is located. And that is the name that has been given to that water that is fed from the Gihon Springs. And so, I want you to remember that. Now, what's the background for our passage today? We're going to get to the message in a minute. The background is found in chapter 8, verse 59. Now, remember, chapter divisions were not put there by the Bible writers. When John is penning his gospel, there is no chapter 9 heading. You read in verse 59, and this is after Jesus has said that your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. In other words, I'm God, I'm Messiah. And what did they do in verse 59? Then took they up stones to cast at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. Now, I do not know how he hid himself. I don't know if he became an invisible man. I don't know if he threw shade and their eyes just darkened and they could not see him as he was passing through them. He went through the midst of them and passed by. That is the happening at this temple. Now, what was the occasion for him being at that temple? Well, you can go back to chapter 7. We won't do it. I'll just tell you what it is. But there is a festival that is called the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, when we think of a tabernacle, we think of something that is big. If you've ever heard of a man named Harold Seitler, you know that for many years over in Greenville, he had a huge church called the Tabernacle. Spurgeon, he preached at the Tabernacle. There have been churches. There's one down in Covington, the Baptist Tabernacle. The old Baptist Tabernacle that was in Atlanta, Lynn G. Broughton was a little guy. He's about five foot tall, and he was a longtime preacher at the Baptist Tabernacle. And it disappointed me so greatly. It had become a place of disrepair. The church really was not even meeting there. And when the 96 Olympics came to Atlanta, somebody bought the old Baptist Tabernacle and turned it into the House of Blues. And I'm thinking, the place where God met with his people all of those many years, and old Lynn G. Broughton would preach and people would be saved by the hundreds, turned into a juke joint. That disappointed me to no end. But the tabernacle has long been a name. And so you have these people and they are going into a tabernacle. That is not the same tabernacle. A tabernacle is a tent. Just like the Old Testament tabernacle, it was a big tent. And they moved it from place to place to place to place. The temple is different than the tabernacle. The temple was a permanent location. But the tabernacle was not. And so these people would come in to the Feast of Tabernacles, which meant that they all had their own little booth or their own little tent. And that's where they would sleep. And the city would swell in its population. So the tabernacle is a tent, and these people are just about to call it, you know, over. The festival's about done. Every day, a priest has come in. He has gotten a pitcher of water out of the Pool of Siloam. He's walked back to the temple, and he has poured it on the altar. And every night, the priest would hang these huge, huge, massive torches up there in one of the main areas. And in those main areas, they would have lights so that they could dance the night away in their festivities. That is what was going on with the feast. It was a time of rejoicing. What were they celebrating? They were celebrating the water from the rock during the time of Moses and the 40 years in the wilderness. That's what the Feast of Tabernacles was all about. And so Jesus is preaching to them, telling them who he is, and it ticks them off. They take up stones, and all of a sudden, where did he go? That's the background. Now we come to chapter 9 into our text today. The first thing that I want you to see is I want you to see the disability. Verse 1, and as Jesus passed by, in other words, as he is leaving the temple through the midst of them, they don't know what's happening. They just know they have nobody to throw that rock at. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from birth. So Jesus has his disciples and they are following him. But instead of getting out of Dodge where these guys that are inside of the temple have their rocks and they're ready to start throwing them, Jesus stops and just begins to look at a blind man. and his disciples. Not unsaved people. His disciples ask him, saying, "Master, who did sin? This man or his parents that he was born blind?" Now, I want you to think about this. Have you not had those same thoughts whenever you see somebody and they're in a tight? Wonder what that guy did. Wonder why God zapped him. I wonder what that woman did. Yeah, I bet you that's why she got the trouble she's got right now. These men believe that. This was something that was heavily taught in Judaism. And each one of these guys, they were raised as Jewish boys. They were all raised in the Galilee. Most of them were fishermen and country type people. The only one that was not was Judas Iscariot. He was a Judean. But you've got these guys, but they were trained in rabbinical school, at least to a certain age. And so they understood that mindset. Now, to me, that question, the first part of it, who did sin? This man? Now, wait a minute. It says that he was born blind. So are these men so stupid to think that before a baby is born, that baby could sin? I mean, that just kind of seems nutty to us. But you got to remember something. You've got to remember that if they knew the writings of David, David said that he was born in sin and in iniquity did he get conceived. And so you've got these people that believed that maybe before the physical birth, that maybe that fetus, that pre-born infant, could have done something in the womb. And maybe God goes, "I saw that," and all of a sudden, because of that, you're blind. That's a pretty hard thing to swallow. Now, the second thing was, well, did his mom and dad do it? And Jesus looks at those guys and he goes, "Neither." The baby didn't do it. And now he's a grown man and he's not had to live his whole life blind. The man never one time saw the shining of a moon on the Sea of Galilee. He never one time got to see the sunset in the Negev. He never one time got to take a hike up the pathways near En Gedi and get some fresh water where David and his men had fresh water. He never got to see any of that because he was born blind. And so when Jesus says, "Neither of them sinned," then why? They only could think of two reasons. Either he sinned or the mom and dad sinned. And Jesus goes, "No, there's a third reason, boys." He said, "But that the works of God should be made manifest in him." Now, I have circled in my Bible that word "in." You will hear people and they'll say things like this: "Well, we don't think that God would ever let a child have a birth defect." And every time I hear that, my eyes go, "Really?" I'm thinking about some of the sweetest kids that I have ever known were born with a disability. They'd never expected him to make it to 20. But in Mountain Park this morning, there is a man named Brian Moody. Brian has been such a loving man and a loving young boy when he was a kid. If he were to come in this room right now, and he's probably 60 years old, he would come in this room, he would come up to me, he would put his arms around my waist, and he would lay his head on my chest. And he would just hold on. He would not let go. Did God let him be born with Downs? Yeah, he did. You say, what kind of God would do something like this? A God that's wiser than you. A God that's wiser than me. I don't understand that. But I know that families that have had children, that have had disabilities, I know that they have had a joy that other people have not experienced. Now, would they change that? Some probably would, some probably would not. But here, Jesus gives the answer for that question. He says that the works of God should be made manifest. If you want to know what the word manifest means, it means to be made known. So if we read it with the definitions of manifest, and we think about the little word in, it would say this, it would say that the works of God should be made known in that blind man. So in other words, God has a reason for that. What is that reason? Sometimes we may know, sometimes we may not know. But it is doing the person a disservice if we say, well, we know you've sinned. That's why God has chastened you. You don't know that they have sinned. And you and I, we need to be very careful about being judge, jury, and executioner, because we may not know. And so, there is that disability that is there. And then Jesus goes on to explain a little bit more. He said, I must work the works of him that sent me. He's speaking of the Father. While it is day, the night cometh. Now, when is that? Well, metaphorically, it's going to be at the crucifixion. There's going to be a nighttime cometh when no man can work. So as long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. Now, remember what I told you about the end of the tabernacle, that feast? And every night, even on that last night, they have those torches up there, and all of a sudden that light goes out. But while Jesus is here, he's the light of the world. But there'll come a time when the light will not be there. And there will come a time when the light will not shine into an unsaved person's life, and they will never trust Christ. It'll be over. So there is a disability. Second of all, there is the deliverance. I want you to look with me in verse 6. And when he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle. And he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. The word anointed simply means he rubbed it. I often think about this when David was anointed. When I think about the different anointings that took place in the Old Testament, usually I think in terms of pouring. But here it has the idea of not just putting it on, but literally rubbing it. I guess it'd be like you ladies taking your makeup off and putting some cream on at night. I guess that's what it would be like. It'd be like going to the beach and rubbing some sunscreen on you. And so you've got that rubbing that has taken place. And it says that he put it on the eyes of the blind man. And he said unto him, go wash in the pool of Siloam. There is nothing about salvation yet. Jesus just simply stops as he is getting away from those guys that are trying to stone him. But yet he has time for people, and he says, he didn't sin. His parents didn't sin. And he just simply says, I'll help him. So he puts spittle mixed with clay, rubs it on his eyes. Now go wash. And so the man does that. And it says, so you go wash. He went. His way, therefore, he washed and came seeing. So in other words, he did what he was told to do, and all of a sudden, there's a difference in his life. So what is that difference? It's the difference between meeting Christ and not meeting Christ. There are people, and they go through their life, and they have no desire whatsoever to ever come in contact with the Son of God. Yet there's other people, like David Wood, and he began to learn about Christ, and all of a sudden, he was like, if you're real, I need you to show me that you're real. And God did. And now for many years, he has grown and grown, and now he is one of the leading apologists for Christian things such as the God-man being 100% God and 100% man at the same time, how that Jesus is the Son of God, he is God, and he can defend that in a great way against any and all comers. A dear friend of mine that preaches for us sometimes named Tom Wallace, and he has a ministry to Muslims. And I'm wondering if he and David would collaborate with each other. That's what I'm wondering. And so you've got this deliverance that takes place. But there's also a third thing this morning, and that's a bunch of discussions that take place. Now, let me tell you something. When Jesus gets in the midst, there's all kind of talk. There's all kind of questions. And you've got many, many different ones. The first thing that we see is in verse 8 and 9. And you've got the neighbors. And the neighbors, they began to go, is that same guy that's been blind? Is that the guy that's lived across the street from us? Is that same boy that used to run in our yard and run into our trees and, you know, run into, you know, walls, anything like that, because he was blind from the time he was born? Is that the same kid? I don't know if that's the same kid or not. And then all of a sudden he hears me, he goes, that's me. I'm the one. I'm different. And so he begins to share his faith. Well, not only do the neighbors think about that, but all of a sudden the Pharisees, they begin to go, we need to talk to that guy. Why is that? Because Jesus did something that not only ticked them off, they wanted him to be stoned, but then they said, but he's done something that's just as egregious as that. He healed him on the Sabbath day. In other words, we know that he can't be from God because he worked on the Sabbath day. You say, I don't understand that. Well, that's because you're not Jewish. There are certain things that have been written down in the writings of the Old Testament and then commentaries by Jewish people such as the Talmud, the Mishnah, those types of things. And they say things like this. You're supposed to be so rigid that you're not even supposed to eat an egg that was cooked on the Sabbath day. You cook your meals before you eat. Now, it's okay to eat, but you can't do any cooking that day. And you've got people and they say, well, he should not have healed that man on Saturday. And I'm thinking, you know, some things are just more important than other things. I think that church is an important thing. But I also think that there are some other things that would supersede that. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say that Brother Chad, after Sunday school, had a teenager and they said, we've been under such conviction. We don't know Christ. Can you take time right now and show me how to be saved? Can I tell you it would be better for him to lead that kid to Christ than it would be for him to be on time to the service? Amen. It's more important. Do you see what I'm talking about? It's more important for Jesus to give a man his sight than it is for him to say, oh, I can't do any work. What's work? Dirt and spittle. That's not much work. But you know, that's something that a legalist was big into. One of the studies that you can do in your New Testament is what is called the Sabbath day controversies. One time they're walking through a field. They can't walk very far because it's the Sabbath day, but they're hungry, and so what do? They take a stalk of corn and they break an ear off and they open it up and they eat it raw. You say, well, that's got to be cooked. Don't tell me if you were raised somewhere in Georgia that you hadn't eaten a raw ear of corn. When I was a kid growing up, if my granddaddy grew it, we probably ate it in the field. I know we ate watermelons and tomatoes in the field. And I'm telling you right now, I've eaten raw corn. These guys took an ear of corn, shucked it, ate it. Oh, your disciples are sinners. They ate corn. They picked corn on the Sabbath day. And Jesus goes, have you not read that David and his men were hungry and they ate the holy bread that was for the priest, that was on the table of showbread at the tabernacle? They ate the priest's bread. So in other words, there's some things that supersede. Let me tell you something. A man that is blind that now can see, he don't care if it was Saturday or Sunday or Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. When I got saved, I'm glad that it was the day that it was, because I could not have felt like I could have made it to the next day. It was a changed life. And so these men, they said, he doesn't keep the Sabbath. And what do you say about that, Mr. Blind Man? Well, the only thing I can tell you is this. I don't know a whole lot about him. I know his name's Jesus, and I think he's a prophet. See, he's not really learned that he's the Son of God yet. But he's happy. What about the parents? The Pharisees go to the mom and dad. That's another discussion. What's going on with your boy? We don't know. Well, you know, he's causing trouble. You know what? He's of age. Go ask him. Leave us alone. Can I tell you that there have been people that have met Christ and their parents didn't know what to do with them since then? When I was in junior high school, there was a family. It was the Kaminsky family. Mr. Kaminsky was raised Jewish. He married a Gentile lady that was a Christian. When that happened, his parents cut him out of their will, and this is like 1965, okay? And that's been a minute ago. He was cut out of a will, and just like that, there went $250,000. Because he had become a Christian, he had married a Christian, and his parents said, you're no son of mine. We're done with you. You're dead to us. Can I tell you that coming to Christ sometimes can break families like that? This man did not know that that was going to take place, but I can tell you this, his mom and dad, they probably had friends and they're going, what's the matter with your kid? Our kid hadn't done that. Well, let me tell you something. Their kids might not have been born blind. Their kid may not have been healed. And if that would have happened, it might have happened in their own house. And so go talk to him. He's of age. So when they come back to him again, this is a next to the last discussion. What happens? Tell us again what happened. This man named Jesus said, go wash after he put clay in my eyes. I don't know how he got to the Pool of Siloam. But ever how he got there, somebody may have led him. Maybe he had already counted the steps over the years and he knew which way to turn on what building that he came, you know, next to. But I know that he gave them this testimony. And one of the things that I noticed about our text is that the more he talked and the more they questioned him, the more firm he got. The more sarcastic he became toward them, the more serious he became going toward Christ. And one of the phrases that I thought was really neat was this. It says in verse 27, will you also be his disciples? In other words, come on in, boys, the water's good. I was blind, now I see. I did what he said, I got blessed. You can too, come on in. And they weren't having any part of it. When they called him back, if you look back at verse 24, they said, give God the praise. You think, what does that mean? Well, it's an Old Testament idiom. An idiom is a phrase or a sentence that is said that if it's taken at face value, you may not really understand it. We use idioms today. If I were to say, that lady kicked the bucket, does that mean that a lady went over and just drop kicked it? No, that's not what that means. We all know that if we say she kicked the bucket, she died. That's what we know. That's an idiom. So here, this idiom is, give God the praise. In other words, it's like our oath in the courtroom. Do you solemnly swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God? In other words, you say this before God. And he does. And so they come at him and he goes, well, why don't you become his disciples? And let me tell you what it cost him. It cost an excommunication. They said, you're a follower of his. He's a sinner. We follow Moses. And he said, let me tell you something. He said, God doesn't bless sinners, but God used him to heal me, so therefore, he's of God, he's not a sinner. He threw their own logic at him. And you know what they did? They kicked him out of the synagogue. The meeting place. The place where they would go and basically hear the reading of the Word of God. The church had not, I think it probably has been institutionalized or organized, but the church really did not get empowered until Pentecost. And so you've got this man, and now he's got to find a whole new set of friends. I referenced Jack Hudson earlier about I got such a jerk. He also said this, when I got saved, I lost half my friends and got a whole new vocabulary. When you get saved, you're different. My time's gone, but let me give you some truths to remember. We don't always know why people suffer. I can't tell you right now why my wife is in intensive care and why the last 5.5 years she's had to go through heart trouble, except for the glory of God. It's not sin, unless it's on my part, because I'm telling you, she loves God. She loves the Lord. When I say, are you at peace with this? Yeah, God's been good to me. I'm good. She's probably told some of you ladies the same thing. I'm good. Now, my girls call it peacocking. You know, when mom gets to church, oh, everything's great, you know. Well, she does peacock a little bit. She's peacocking at the doctor's office the other day. I don't even know if I need this surgery. Yes, you do. And so we don't always know why people suffer, except all things work together for good to those that love the Lord and those that are called according to his purpose. We know that. Number two, God can take bad and make it good. Don't ever forget that. God can take a blind man and give him sight. God can take a heart patient and make her whole. And God can take your burden and make it right. We share Christ because of what he's done. This man didn't know Jesus. And I even skipped the last discussion. The last discussion, do you believe in the Son of God? Well, who's the Son of God? You're talking to the Son of God. Yes, I do. That's when he got saved. We share Christ because of what he's done for us. When I got saved, I wanted to tell everybody. I told my parents right away. I told my aunts, my uncles. I told my cousins. I told the friends in the neighborhood. I mean, I'm telling people that I don't even know. Just witnessing to them. Hey, take this track. This Jesus that this will tell you about, same one that saved me a month ago. Why am I doing that? Because I want to share Christ. We ought to share Christ because of what he's done for us. And remember this, the number one evidence that you're a believer is if you know that there's a change. Now let me just say this, and I'm done. If you get saved when you're 7 years old, you hadn't had time to be a real big sinner. All right? I know that we used to have evangelists that would come in. One of them, I graduated from high school with his daughter. Her name was Debbie Hatch. Her dad's name was Carl Hatch. Carl Hatch would give his testimony, and he would talk about the sins that he had committed. And I mean, he had committed every sin in the book except murder, and he was thinking about that. He was an alcoholic, and I mean, he was just out of control. And God saved him. And it began to kind of go through the youth group. And sometimes young people, they get influenced by things that are not accurate. Some of the people got influenced by his testimony, just like some of you young people get influenced by Instagram, TikTok. Can I tell you that you need to be careful about that? There's nutty people on those apps. There's danger on those apps. And it's not just predators that are, you know, trying to get you to slip out of your house at 10 o'clock at night or 1 o'clock in the morning. It's other young people, and they're trying to get you to commiserate with them, and then all of a sudden, everybody's got a contagion that's going around. Well, if you've got Jesus, you good. You good. And so, you've got these people, and when we were in that youth group, we would say, well, I must not be saved. I don't have a testimony of, you know, robbing banks and taking drugs and getting drunk and all of that. The greatest testimony is to never have done that. But when you get saved, you know that there's been something that has been different. You don't think the same way that you used to think. You don't have the same desires that you used to have. I heard one preacher say one time, he said, a guy told me, he said, man, said, you Christians, y'all don't ever have any fun. And the preacher looked at the guy and said, man, I have more fun than you do. He said, really? He said, yeah. He said, well, you don't drink and you don't smoke. He said, yeah, I do. He said, I smoke all the cigars I want to smoke. I drink all the liquor I want to drink. The guy looked at him and said, you do? He said, yeah, I just don't want to do it no more. And that's exactly right. You know what that is? That's the mark of a changed life. This blind man He didn't just get his eyes restored or given, really. He didn't have them at the beginning. They were just given to him. He got to see those sunsets, and he got to see those sunrises, and he got to see the beautiful face of his mother who gave him birth. He got to see that. But he didn't get to see it until he met Christ. If you want joy, not problem-free life, but if you want joy and peace in the midst of suffering, Jesus is the ticket. Come to Christ.